into 2019 and ahead of the first MotoGP season in a long while without Danny Pedrosa, we're going to have a look at what we're all going to miss. Welcome to Bike Live. Let's go! Yes, for the first time in 2019, welcome everyone to Bike Live here on Motorsport 101. As we look back on a magnificent career for Danny Pedrosa in the Grand Prix World Championship, spanning all classes, he's won in all of them. The only thing he hasn't won is a championship, but without question, a MotoGP Hall of Famer and deserving of that accolade. We'll talk about the career that led him to that honour, some of the highs, some of the lows, and plenty of the injuries, because there were no lack of those. But what a credit Danny Pedrosa has been to the sport of motorcycle racing, and given that his career actively as a rider, as far as racing is concerned, has now come to an end, we feel it was right that we took a bit of time to look back on everything that Danny Pedrosa has brought to motorcycle racing. We will also, given that it's been a month since we last spoke to you, cover all of the important news that has broken over Christmas and the new year. I'm Lewis Sutterby, in case you'd forgotten since Christmas. Joining me for the first time in this new year, Happy New Year to Andre Harrison. Dre, the time since we've last spoke, neither of our football teams has lost a match. Immense.
It's been a glorious time. We should take more month-long breaks. I say, have Hull City get promoted back and have United win the league. Sounds like a plan for Ramsden.
Yes, but remarkable scenes. Just remarkable scenes. How was your Christmas? Good?
Yeah, very good Christmas. We got rid of some Portuguese dude. I had pings and blankets of macaroni cheese for Christmas dinner, and it was delicious. And Jorge Lorenzo is now in Orange. I'm deeply concerned. It was a strange Christmas. I'm still recovering from it. But apparently we're back now. So hooray for bikes and whatnot.
Yes, hell officially froze over this week when I saw that launch from Repsol Honda, which we'll talk about very, very shortly, because there is still plenty of news that has broken, as I mentioned, over the course of the winter break. And we're already in that period of motorcycle racing, and indeed motorsport, it happens in cars too, where we're getting into launch season. Two MotoGP teams, two premier MotoGP teams, the two that we're expecting to contest the World Championship this year in MotoGP, have launched their new lineups and new liveries for the upcoming season, which we'll discuss very, very shortly. And in the time that it takes us to record again on Bike Live, which will probably be in a fortnight, not only will all of the other teams have launched, but also the Sepang test will have taken place. And we'll look ahead to that before we go at the end of tonight's show. So before that, the places you can find us, starting on Facebook, facebook.com/motorsport101. On Twitter, we are at motorsport_101. Our website is motorsport101.com. You can also find show highlights on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/motorsport101. You can also find our podcast. Basically, we're all good podcasts are found on Apple Podcasts and now, Dre, on Spotify.
We're on Spotify now. So, yeah, if you ever get sick and tired of replaying the same five tunes like I do on Spotify every month, yeah, we're now on there instead. So, yeah, they just recently had a new beta program for podcasters. So, yeah, we signed up for that and we're on there now. So, if anyone else out there swears by using Spotify, which I know a lot of people do. People have been asking me about this because, funnily enough, someone, I don't know who this was, had uploaded about 60 of our old episodes on Spotify as standard episodes. And now, we at Motorsport 101, we've always had it a direct download link on SoundCloud. We're not fussy about things like that. Like, I'm firmly of the camp of pretty much all publicity is good publicity. So we've always had open downloads, share it around and whatnot. As I've always said, if you're just going to publish it online, just give us some credit. And that's absolutely fine by me, for the record. But we are now officially on Spotify. So all of our library is on there. It's hooked in via RSS with our SoundCloud page. So again, it'll be updated exactly the same time everybody else gets it. So for those guys who swear by Spotify, you're going to follow us on there instead.
You can. And if you like us so much that you'd like to back us financially, you can do so at patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 backing gets you early access to both of our weekly, or at the moment fortnightly, shows until we get into the new season of motorsport, both on two wheels and on four. And $10 backing gives you the opportunity to listen into these podcasts live as they are recorded by joining our Discord server, although we have opened it up a little bit to the public over the course of this winter break. But if you back to the $10 level, you can listen in to our podcast live as they are recorded. And thank you to Steve, who's doing that right now. Right then, let's first get into the news, and the news that has broken in the last month, basically, since we've last spoken. And as I mentioned earlier on, this is a bit of a special show dedicated to the career of Danny Pedrosa. And we're going to start the news by talking about injuries to Danny Pedrosa. Who, of course, his active career as a racer has now come to an end. But he is still a test rider, officially, for KTM. But Dre, unfortunately for the boys in orange, their new test rider won't be featuring for them at Sepang.
No, and probably won't be for quite some time. It's Danny's hurt himself again, everybody. Sad faces all around. He's having some sort of experimental stem cell surgery on his right shoulder, which I think he had just after Christmas, I believe. It was a couple of weeks ago now. Since he's had that, but yeah, we're just catching you up here on some of the older news. But yes, a shoulder injury for Danny P. He won't be being able to really take part in that new KTM test rider role he's got probably for quite some time, unfortunately, which is a shame. But you know, that's like, let's be real here. It's Danny Pedrosa. Let's not know this is the first time that's happened, unfortunately. But of course, we wish him a speedy recovery. We all know that Danny's a warrior, and I'm sure we'll talk about it in future. That he's had his fair share of being on the injury reports, but. Yeah, hopefully a quick one for Danny, and he's back on the bike in some capacity soon.
Well, the sheer number of injuries, which, as Dre mentioned, we'll talk about a little bit later on, have probably kind of led to this. Danny Pedrosa said himself, because he's had several fractures of his collarbone, which is the collarbone that he's having operated on, or he has been operated on, the double stress fracture of his right collarbone, because he's injured that several times in his career. He says it's left it sclerotic is the medical term for it, basically saying that the middle part of it doesn't have enough blood flow to it, and it's creating osteoporosis, bone weakening.
Yikes.
In other words, so it basically needs, in his words, an effective solution to regenerate the bone and achieve adequate recovery. After going several tests and medical consultations, the clear recommendation is the total recovery and bone health. So he's expected to be fighting fit again, as fit as you can be when you've had as many injuries as Danny Pedrosa has, later this year. So KTM, given that they are still a factory team that has concessions available to them, they can do plenty of testing through the year, so Danny Pedrosa will still be plenty of use to KTM, but he won't be riding for them at the Sepang test, which starts in, well, around about a week and a half really from now, probably about a week as you listen to this, if you're listening on the download, in Malaysia. So it'll be down to Paul Espargaro and Joan Zarco to do the factory test riding. Of course, they do now have two extra bikes with their Tech 3 team as well. So it might not be the killer blow that it might have been in previous years for KTM. But it is a shame for Danny Pedrosa. Two teams have launched their new 2019 programs this week. And as I mentioned earlier on, it is the two teams that were expecting, with all due respect to Yamaha and Suzuki, to be fighting for the championship this year. Starting with the Ducati team, who launched theirs at the back end of last week. New livery, Dre, slightly different shade of red, and a brand new mission statement on the side of their bike.
Mission win now on the side. As if I want to be reminded of Ferrari's 2018 season by... I was like, oh, great. So all the Italian brands are going with mission win now. Oh, delightful. My favourite. Although, to be fair, it is a gorgeous livery.
I do love it. I do love this deeper shade of red.
I do love the deeper red. I do love, like, it's like the massive majority colour, because I know last year's was a lot of white and a lot of grey on there as well, which was a bit of an odd choice for them. But I do love the majority red livery. I think it's a very rich red. I do like that a lot. I'm a big fan of that. So, yeah, from that standpoint, I can't complain. It's a very solid-looking livery. The Panigale has always been a beautiful bike, and there's Mondeshi GP18 and now 19 has always been a very pretty thing. No complaints from me on that one. I just don't like the blooming great big mission win now goddamn sponsor on the fairing. Like I don't need to be reminded of this. Okay, we get it. You're trying to advertise tobacco without not really advertising tobacco. It's a pain.
Yeah, it's like Jakatia going to great lengths to let us know where their money's coming from, because not only have we got the Mission Winnow livery courtesy of Philip Morris International, but we've also got the Audi Sport stickers on the side of their bikes for the first time, which I think is their way of putting to bed any rumours that Ducati may be sold. So it's pretty clear that Audi, VW Audi Group are pretty keen to have Ducati under their umbrella, and it's proving quite a profitable organisation for them, and they're hoping it will become a championship winning organisation for them this year too. Yamaha's factory team are also going to be having a change of livery this year, which we'll no doubt tell you about on our next podcast. Given that their new name is Monster Energy Yamaha, expect it to be a lot of black and a lot of green. Expect it to look like the Tech 3 bike did last year, in all probability. But sticking with Ducati for a moment, because they launched their new factory team, which, if you've been living under a rock or if you didn't follow the news last year, is now Andrea Dovizioso and Danilo Petrucci. Petrucci looks absolutely beaming, by the way, to be in factory leathers.
He's so happy.
Yeah, he just looked like
the man in the world.
Boyhood dream come true. But to be fair, although it's launch is usually very, very dull, and this was no exception. As they went behind the scenes, Gavin Emmett did his best to dress it up as an exciting event. We had the we had the Italian whose idea it was to come up with this Mission Winnow concept, trying to explain what it meant. And we all sort of switched off in our droves as he basically tied himself in knots trying to explain how he came up with the slogan. But perhaps the one big piece of news that did come from that launch, Dre, was, I don't think it was necessarily intended as such, but Claudio Domenicali, the CEO of Ducati, did find a nice indirect way of putting one last boot into the side of Jorge Lorenzo's solar plexus.
I believe the quote was the lines of, like, it's nice to finally have a team where both its riders are working together towards the same goal. Now, Dovi is still there. He's obviously still the constant in this Ducati team for the last few years, and now Petrucci's there. I wonder what that says about the former teammate who's been jettisoned out of the team from last year. Again, Domenicali, you're fooling no one here. We know exactly who you're talking about on that one. And I'll leave the jury out for that one. But as I put it out on there on Twitter yesterday, it's like, I do find it kind of funny that Jorge Lorenzo has now pretty much been in like three team blow-ups now in like the last, what shall we say, half decade or so. He seems to be the common trend here, and that's probably not a good thing for Lorenzo in the long run. But hey, he's joined up with Marquez now. What's the worst that could possibly happen?
Yeah, right? Can't see anything going on. More on that in a second. But it kind of confirms what I think a lot of us suspected, Dre, even though Ducati didn't outright come out and say it, that it is a change of strategy from the Mission Winnow Ducati team, which we're not going to call them that every time, but that is their official name now. That they clearly don't think that the two number ones strategy to a team is the way of winning a championship, do they? You know, you could argue that having Jorge Lorenzo there didn't necessarily cost them the 2017 championship, but he didn't exactly make it easy for them, did he? You'd expect one of your own riders to make life easier for you, not more difficult. But in Sepang and Valencia, Lorenzo was more of a complication than a teammate to Dovizioso. But whilst Danilo Petrucci won't in his own mind be going there to be Dovi's lackey or to play the supporting role, it seems as if although they're not saying it directly, that's what Ducati see Petrucci as. And surely, assuming everything goes as we're expecting, surely Dovizioso will be the big winner out of this.
Well, that's the logic I've got. I mean, if Yamaha has taught me anything from the last half decade, it's that having two number ones don't work in MotoGP. Like, we saw it with Rossi and Lorenzo, and we saw it especially in 2016. Well, in 15 they got away with it because their bike was just clearly better than the Hondas. But the year afterwards, in 2016, both Yamahas took so many points off each other in fights against Marquez. Marquez had a golden goose and was able to just cakewalk his way to the title in the end because Yamaha was so self-destructive. And that's always kind of been their mentality, by having such a strong team of Rossi and Lorenzo, two very big character sort of riders. And Ducati have been doing that. Ducati, I've always said, they're like the big free agent team. They're like the big flashy signing. they've, you know, from Stoner and Rossi and Hayden and Dovey, Crutchlow before, they've always stocked up on big name riders. And this is the first time really in modern times where they've not had this quote unquote super team, where they've, you know, Petrucci, you know, he's a great rider, but we know he's not in that alien ballpark of Dovey, Marquez, Rossi, Vinales, Lorenzo, etc. He's kind of probably in that next stage down. And it looks like, as you say, they're going towards a 1-2 strategy. I mean, the way they've worded it and the way they've gone around it, I don't think they've made it any secret by any stretch that Petrucci's basically been backup man to Dovey here. And you're absolutely right. Dovey's the big winner here. We all know he is good enough to carry a team. He is now probably the second best rider in the world. He is more than good enough, you know, to be able to lead a team going forward. He can challenge for the title if everything falls to place. And Petrucci's probably not going to get in his way, because we saw it last season that Lorenzo came good at the completely wrong time. It ended up just
as they got rid of him.
Yeah, just as they got rid of him. Lorenzo got good at the wrong time, and then they just started taking points off each other, and it all just got problematic to the point where the two of them pretty much didn't like each other on the way out. It was a toxic situation, and as the Mercalli came out and proved it was obvious which side of the fence they were leaning towards on that one. They know where their bread was buttered. I mean, I've said this from day one. When Dovey had that win at Mugello a couple of years ago and he got the hero's welcome back at the factory, literally the entire Ducati factory staff chanting his name. You knew that was his team. And that, like, he's the Alan Prost of that team now. He runs things around here. So, yeah, Dovey is absolutely going to be the biggest winner out of this scenario. It's just a matter of now, is that do they have something in the tank to tackle Marquez?
Which brings us nicely to Repsol Honda. Who, as we've discussed moments ago, have signed Jorge Lorenzo. Now, Ducati have gone for the 1-2 strategy. They clearly feel that having a number one and a number two rider, even if they don't directly call them that, is the best way to go. Now, we could argue Repsol Honda have gone the other way. They have now got two number ones. Although, Dre, could you argue, with all due respect to Jorge Lorenzo, a 5-times world champion, that in the current era of MotoGP, no matter how good you are, any rider in the same team of Marc Marquez is the number two rider?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to argue that point. I mean, I said that Honda, and I remember watching the test at Valencia the day after the season finished and having Spalders talking about the state of Repsol Honda, and, you know, the seeming nature of the fact that he said, well, it's such a specialised bike now that really the only person that can fully utilise it is Marquez. So I don't think the transition is going to be quite so bad for Lorenzo coming from Ducati over to Honda. I think they're a bit more similar in that aspect compared to going from Yamaha to Ducati. But I do think this is still going to be Marquez's team for the foreseeable future. And I think Lorenzo is walking into hell here with Marquez on the same bike. I mean, they were very pally on camera during their team launch a couple of days ago, which
we're going to come to that. They launched their team in Madrid on Wednesday, and I don't know whether it was just me, Dre, but even though this news has been official since midway through last year, we knew Lorenzo was going to Repsol Honda, but just the images of Lorenzo and Marquez side by side in Repsol Honda liveries, shaking hands and smiling with a 99 on the front of a Repsol Honda. I had to double take.
It's like, how did we get to this point? What is going on here?
Pigs, like, are flying.
Yeah, pigs are flying. Someone's fired a pig out of a cannon over my house, clearly. I don't understand this, but it's funny because I still remember Marquez's like third ever career race at Jerez like it was yesterday, where he basically barged Lorenzo off the apex with a block pass at his own corner. Lorenzo finger wagging like, no, you don't do this in the big boy sport, son. Refused to shake his hand, and like 5 years later, they're now teammates, and you know, thumbs up in the back, and Lorenzo praising Marquez's achievements on Twitter, and they're all pally at the moment. I don't think this is going to last, kids.
No.
I really don't. But hey, prove me wrong, Jorge.
Yeah, Dovey certainly hopes so.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, Lorenzo in white and orange is a very, very weird look. So that's going to take some getting used to. I thought Ducati was mad enough, but you know, Ducati said Ducati love a free agency, dude. So that one didn't surprise me quite so much. But him in orange with Marquez as a teammate, smiling, shaking hands. What's going on? It's surreal. It's crazy seeing that.
And the fact that Repsol Honda and both Lorenzo and Marquez themselves are referring to it as the dream team.
That is tempting fate.
Yeah, exactly. Jorge Lorenzo, in the official press release that Repsol Honda sent out after the launch, said, "My main objective for 2019 is first of all to be 100% recovered," which we'll come on to in a second, "and to be able to demonstrate on track that we really are the dream team that people are talking about." But these are two riders with rather large egos, which isn't a criticism of them, because all great riders, all great champions have great egos. That's what makes them what they are. But ultimately, one of them is going to have to come second to the other. And whoever that is clearly not going to be very happy about it. And the fact that Jorge Lorenzo is going into this new season, Dre, injured. I mean, he's not going to be at the Sepang test, which takes place at the end of this month, beginning of February. And he says his hope is to be 95% fit for the first round in Qatar. It is a concern. Lorenzo, this is kind of a legacy of the injury that he sustained all the way back in Thailand when he broke his scaphoid. Or he broke his wrist, and he's now since broken the same left scaphoid in training in Verona in sort of preparation for this season. And, you know, they tried their best to cover it up, but you could see when he was in full team leathers at the launch, he had that strapping, that protection on his wrist. Left wrist. So they, despite their best efforts, it was clear to see that he wasn't fully fit. And I mean, beating Marc Marquez at the best of times is difficult. Beating him on the same bike is near impossible. Beating him on the same bike when you're not even fully fit, Jorge Lorenzo's, he's almost on a hiding to nothing before he's even started.
Yeah, this seems like damage limitation right from the get-go. And as I mentioned before, Marquez is arguably strongest two rounds are right at the front of the season.
So I mean, Marquez isn't fully fit at the moment either, but even so.
No. I mean, to be fair, Marquez has said himself he's probably going to be 2 or 3 months before he's 100% himself from that shoulder he had. But he's out here jogging already. by all accounts, it looks like the shoulder's healing well. If he's able to go out and take, you know, hiking runs with it, he clearly is. Like, it's ridiculous. It's one of those things where it's like, okay, the blessing here is that Marquez isn't fully fit himself. But you look at the calendar. You're 95%. He was talking about being 95% fit for Qatar. Marquez lost Qatar last year by a nose. And then rounds 2 and 3 are the Circuit of the Americas and Argentina, two Marquez staple hold tracks. I mean, Marquez's winning record there probably doesn't do it justice given the amount of shenanigans that have gone down in Argentina over the years. But we all know he's ludicrously fast around there. And of course, Cota, literally unbeatable. So you've got two Marquez banker rounds right at the start of the year, and Lorenzo's going to be recovering from injury. It could get ugly quite quickly here if Lorenzo isn't anywhere near fully fit by then. But that wrist seems like it's a problematic thing. I mean, what if he crashes on that during a session? Like, is that before?
Yeah, because the Thailand crash was 3.5 months ago.
Yeah. Like, he's clearly got some sort of lingering arm problem where, like, they said that same injury was nearly 4 months ago, and he's still hurting from it. And obviously, he's, like, he was in apparently so much pain he had to be rushed into hospital when it happened. So, yeah, like, this was bad. By all accounts, this is bad, and it raises an eyebrow for, like what's Lorenzo's future going to be like here, given that he's clearly hurting, and that is clear that wrist is nowhere near 100%, especially even after he's training on it, and he crashes in training, and he's hurt himself again. So I hope there's not a deep significance here going on with Lorenzo, and it is just what it is at face value, where it's just another break. But it is a bit concerning that he's had, you know, two fractures like that in the space of 4 months, and he's had to have surgery on it twice. So the first time he missed 4 rounds.
Exactly. So although it all looks Sweetness and Light at Repsol Honda, the dream team, as they're calling themselves for this new season, and yeah, it was an amazing sight to have Lorenzo Marquez at the launch with Alex Crevier and Mick Doohan flanking them in their historic Repsol Honda liveries with the bikes that they were so successful on, respectively. Was an incredible sight. It was a very well done launch from Repsol Honda in Madrid earlier this week. But we're going to shift our focus to World Superbikes for the time being and the World Superbike paddock across all classes because they've been testing this week, yesterday and today actually, as we talk now on Thursday, January the 24th. And their two-day test has come to an end. And I guess who was fastest? Well, you all know who was fastest. It was Jonathan Rea. The reigning four times world champion, who was fastest, not by much though. He was fastest on a 139.1, just 0.2 clear of Alex Lowes on the Pat Yamaha. Lowes, who was fastest on the first day, so clearly a promising test, all things considered, for the Pat Yamaha official World Superbike team. Their GRT team was launched today this week, and it is going to be fiendishly difficult to tell their four bikes apart this year. Because the GRT Yamaha team essentially has the exact same livery as the factory Pata team, with Lowes and Vandermark, and of course GRT have Cortese and Melandri. So we kind of have four identical Yamahas out there next over the course of this season. But Rea was fastest from Lowes. Leon Haslam, of course, is Jonathan Rea's teammate now, was third fastest on a 139.5, just ahead of Alvaro Bautista. Fourth fastest on the new Ducati V4 Panigale, with less than half a second off the outright pace, which obviously we can only take these lap times at face value, but for a rider new to the class on a bike that's new full stop, that's promising for Ducati to be that close to the front. Toprak Razgatlioglu was fifth on the Pecetti Kawasaki. Sandro Cortese, sixth already, top six on the GRT Yamaha, which is promising for the reigning super sport champion. Vandermark 7th, Eder Melandri, Ruben Rinaldi and Chaz Davies. With Leandro Mercado 11th, Eugene Laverty, who's now on a Ducati for the Go 11 team in 12th place. Jordi Torres, who's running for the Pedicini team in 13th. The BMW factory bikes of Tom Sykes and Marcus Reiterberg were 14th and 15th, 2 seconds off the pace. They weren't running transponders that were recording lap times for much of the test, so how much we can truly glean from that is anyone's guess. They didn't actually record any lap times at all on day one, even though they were running around all day, so we don't quite know how fast they really are. And Alessandro Del Bianco on the Altea MIE racing bike was 16th, essentially on a third Honda, because of course Altea are running the Morawaki back to Honda factory team, who were not at this test. Interestingly, although of course they will be at Phillip Island for the pre-season test that takes place just before the opening round there. Supersport and Supersport 300s were also there too, but we're going to take you through their entry lists before we move on, because they have been officially confirmed. The final entry lists have now been published for all three classes. The World Superbike entry list has only 18 riders on it, which is a shame, but there is no lack of quality on it. There are no sort of tail end Charlies on this entry list, and we'll run you through that in much greater detail when we preview the new season in probably two shows' time. But as far as the Super Sport entry list is concerned, I'll run you through it. Callio Racing, of course, winners of the championship last season with Sandro Cortese. They've brought in another ex-Moto2 rider to try and retain the title with. It's Isaac Viñales, who will be riding for them, the Spaniard on the number 32, alongside Thomas Gradinger, who was Cluzel's team at NRT last season, had the odd good result, and Loris Cresson, so they're their three riders. MV Agusta retained Raffaele De Rosa, although quite frankly they'd have been stupid not to, with Federico Fellini as his teammate. He's another rider out of Moto2. The Badal Evan Bros team have possibly the strongest team on paper. Two Yamaha R6s, and their two riders are Randy Krumenacker and Federico Caracasulo. The CIA Landlord Insurance Honda team have Jules Danilo, another ex-Moto2 rider. And although the entry list does say TBA, they have confirmed this week that it will be the Hungarian Peter Sebastian. Kawasaki Pichetti are racing with Lucas Mayas and Hikari Okubo. More on them in a moment. Yamaha GMT94 have picked up Jules Cluzel, last season's, well, perennial title challenger until the final round. And Corentin Perolari, who impressed in the second half of last season when he arrived in the paddock. Wilsport Race Days running two Hondas for Hannes Sommer and Jaime Van Sicklerus. The Gemar Corsa team are running Alfonso Coppola and Gabriele Ryu. Rob Hartog stays with the Team Hartog against Kansas squad, the Dutchman. Nacho Calero will be riding for Orolac on a Kawasaki. Two ESS runners, which will be riding at the European rounds only. They are two Frenchmen, Xavier Navand and Gaetan Merton. Glenn Van Stralen, the Dutchman who was in Supersport 300, he's now riding for the EAB racing team in Supersport 600. Maria Herrera is one of the high-profile additions to the Supersport Championship. She'll be combining this with her MotoE program. She'll be running for the MS racing team. Ayrton Badovini will be running a Kawasaki for Team Pedicini, and a Yamaha run by Team Toth will be ridden by Hector Barbera. So, Dre, a few things to pick out from there. Mm. I mean, first of all, I'm interested by the fact that there are a number now of ex-Moto2 sort of back-end riders who are now clearly looking at what Cortese has done and thinking that maybe Supersport's their best future path. Isaac Vinales, Jules Danilo, Federico Fellini, following the likes of Barbera and Cortese, of course, and Krumenacker, we shouldn't forget, who, of course, have been in Moto2 but are now in Supersport. But I want to talk about Lucas Mayas. It was probably the big change from last season. Course, it was a Yamaha-dominated championship last season, but I guess, are we this year, in 2019, going to find out just how good that Kawasaki ZX6R genuinely still is now that they've got Lucas Mayas on it?
Yeah, well, this will be the litmus test, isn't it? Lucas Mayas has been one of the strongest guys in Supersport now for the last 2 years. He was brilliant on a Yamaha, we all know that. But then again, a lot of riders were pretty brilliant on that Yamaha.
Yeah, that's the thing. You could argue last year that Yamaha was so strong because they had all the best riders on their bikes. And of course, Kawasaki lost to Foglu.
Yeah, and Sofoglu, we all know, was basically almost freakish. Like, some sort of black magic voodoo was the only reason he was so fast on that Kawasaki compared to everybody else who seemingly struggled with it. So, this will be the litmus test. If Mahias is up there with a Kawasaki, you know, ZX6R, then, you know, we'll know that he really is, you know, one or two of these, you know, best riders in the field. If he isn't, we all know that Kawasaki really is a dog, and he's made a terrible career choice. It's going to be one or the other, I'm afraid. And because we all know Yamaha has been the premier super sport brand now for 2 or 3 years now. Yamaha have dominated the championship. We all saw that last season where they had 5 of the top 6 title contenders. More like Raffaele De Rosa was a breath of fresh air on that MV. Everybody else was on Yamahas. Whether that holds up remains to be seen. But yeah, Mayas is the litmus test. We'll soon find out how the Kawasaki will stack up with a classified elite rider in the class in that sense. So yeah, well, it's going to be probably the most intriguing part of these new rider lineups.
Yeah, it is. It's going to be interesting to see how they get on. As far as the Yamaha teams are concerned, because they've all basically changed. NRT have gone. Although, to be fair, we fear that they might have even made the end of last season, so we're kind of grateful that they did to give Clouzel every chance of winning the title. Caleo Racing, of course, have lost Cortese, but they've replaced him with Vinales and Gradinger. Vinales hoping to be as good on a Yamaha as his cousin is. But that Badal Evan Bros team surely is the strongest on paper, Dre, with Krumenacker and Kara Kasulo. GMT94, though, with Corentin Perolari, who, given that he was new to the class last year, did very well on the few outings he had. But I want to talk about Jules Clouzel, who, of course, we always look to in Supersport because we're hoping the Wall is eventually going to win a title. But have you seen his social media this week from the test?
I have not, no.
Well, I've got his Instagram in front of me, and I don't think I'm wrong to be slightly concerned by this. Because we shouldn't forget what happened to him the last time we saw him on a bike in Qatar last year. For this year, on his Yamaha R6, he's going to be running a gear lever. Rather than a gear lever by his foot, he's going to be riding a gear lever on his right-hand handlebar, which is going to take some getting used to, because he clearly doesn't want to be changing gear with his left foot, given how badly he smashed his ankle up in Qatar last year, which has got to be a concern to me. Not only is he not clearly not 100% fit, but he's having to learn a whole new way of riding a motorcycle.
Yeah, that's going to be a severe case of work in progress, by the sounds of it. I did not know this on the Instagram page, that Clouzel had basically fundamentally changed his bike. And yeah, it's a great point. I mean, I don't think we mentioned it at the time. That was his braking ankle he smashed up. And that's not good. And now he's going to be basically going into a brand new season. Yes, we all know the Yamaha Artics is a weapon, and we all know Clasel is most likely going to win multiple races on it next season. But I'm not so sure about that now because, yeah, as you say, he's now got to fundamentally change his entire riding style, which is such a prominent strength of Clasel's. He's probably the best defensive rider on the planet, and now he's got to change his braking? That is not a good combination of problems to have. We'll have to wait and see again how this plays out in race trim and by the time the season starts up in Phillip Island, but That is a trifle concerning that he's now got to relearn how to basically stop a motorcycle properly. And that is arguably the strongest part of Clasel's arsenal. So, yeah, definitely one to be concerned about.
Yeah, because yesterday, as we're speaking, Wednesday the 23rd of January yesterday, the first day of the two-day Jerez test, was the first time he'd ever ridden the bike under that configuration. So, surely, given that these riders naturally are creatures of habit. They have been used to riding a certain way. They all have their own styles, their own idiosyncrasies. It's not going to be an overnight job that for Clasel to get to grips with it and then learn how to ride it fast. So we'll see how quickly he adjusts to that, and we'll probably get our first answer in Phillip Island in around about a month's time. Because, of course, World Superbikes, quite handily for us, starts very early. So it's only a month away now, the start of the new season. World Supersport 300 are going to have to wait a little longer. They start at Aragon at the end of March. But they've also confirmed their entry list. The first big headline to take from this is there are 50 permanent entries on the Supersport 300 World Championship entry list for this season, which explains why they've brought in the last chance qualifying race for this year, because they're obviously not going to have enough grid slots to put every rider on it. So we're going to have qualifying, we're then going to have, I forget the number, but it's around the 30 mark, that are going to go straight through to the race itself on the Sunday. And then everyone who's outside of that cutoff are going to be in a last chance qualifying race where the top six make it in to the main race on the Sunday, which is going to be quite the spectacle. In 2019, we're essentially going to have two Supersport 300 races a weekend, one for the tail end Charlies and then one for everyone else on the Sunday. I won't take you through the full entry list, naturally, because we'll be here until April, but there are some interesting names to bring you. Anna Carrasco, of course, is back to defend her title. She'll be running the number one plate, and she'll be riding for a new team. Well, a new team to this class. Kawasaki Provec World SSP 300. Which, if you're not familiar, Provec is essentially the Spanish-run team that runs the Kawasaki Factory World Superbike outfit. So Anna Carrasco has got probably the strongest team in the whole paddock behind her for this year as she defends her title in Supersport 300. Other interesting names to bring you, Marc Garcia. Yeah, if you remember his name, he was the inaugural Supersport 300 World Champion. He won the title in 2017. And he's back to try and regain the title with the DS Junior team on number four. So we're going to have both existing Supersport 300 World Champions on the grid this year in 2019. A number of the key names that you've seen in previous years are still around. Mika Perez, last year's runner-up. He's still around for the Scuderia Maranga racing team on a Kawasaki Ninja 400 alongside Borja Sanchez. Scott DeRue, who many will feel was cruelly robbed of a chance of winning the title with that mechanical in Magny-Cours. He's staying with the Motoport Kawasaki team on a Ninja 400 alongside Robert Schottmann. So they're retaining their all-Dutch lineup. All of the main runners from last season, with the exception of Glenn Van Straalen, who I've just mentioned to you, is running in Supersport next year, are sticking around. But yeah, it's a strong, strong field. But as I mentioned, 50 riders. Four different makes of bike. We're going to have a Honda CBR 500 on the grid for the Frenchman Adrien Quinet. But the bulk of the field is made up of Kawasaki Ninja 400s, Yamaha R3s, and the KTM RC 390s, which we saw appearing last year. And there are going to be four of them on the grid this year. We'll preview that class in much greater detail in the run-up to the Aragon World Superbike round, which will be in a couple of months' time. But World Supersport 300 has 50 entries for this year. British Superbike news before we move on to the bulk of the show and talking about Danny Pedrosa. British Superbikes, and they have basically filled the one remaining slot on the grid that was left open before Christmas for 2019. That spot was at Build Base Suzuki. And Drake's been filled by Luke Stapleford, who was conspicuous by his absence from the World Supersport entry list. We've now found out where he's going. And it has to be said, assuming that Bradley Ray has recovered from the kind of the dip that he suffered at the end of 2018 from such a strong start, a Build-Based Suzuki team of Bradley Ray and Luke Stapleford on paper looks pretty strong.
It's very strong. Like, Stapleford, we all know, dominated British Supersport a few years ago. And when I say dominate, I mean beat him down by a country mile. He was completely dominant, and he was looking like one of the real, you know, British young talented hotshots in bike racing, period. We all know World Supersport's been kind of a hot mess for him since he got there a couple of years ago. You know, multiple bike changes, the team kind of collapsing around him a little bit, and he's not really worked out. I mean, now he's getting, he gets to go to British Superbikes, which I think was I think he probably should have done that in the first place, quite frankly, or tried to angle for a seat there rather than jumping into World Supersport. And then that ladder is problematic. There's no guaranteed way in, especially if you see how World Superbikes are shaken out this year with a lot of really good names missing out on seats. As far as I'm concerned, I think this was always the right move for Stapleford, and he's got a really good bike underneath him. The Suzuki is fast. We all know with Bradley Ray, it was capable of winning races. And when Suzuki finds those little gains, they seem to make a big difference. And that's what happened with Bradley Ray this past season. So Stapleford could come in and, you know, utilize the best of his talent, and then that could be a very strong team going forward. Even though they dropped Richard Cooper for him, which I do find a little bit eyebrow-raising.
Yeah, we were going to mention that. Richard Cooper, who I think we're both agreed on this show, on talent alone, deserves to be on the British Superbike grid for 2019. Although the field just gets stronger and stronger, of course, with the likes of Scott Redding moving into British Superbikes and Javi Forres, of course, out of World Superbikes into British Superbikes for this year. It is almost a world-class field now in British Superbikes. But Richard Cooper, of course, won the final round of last season in the Weta Brands Hatch. He's now gone to Superstock 1000, staying with the same team. He's going to be riding for Build Base Suzuki, but in Superstock 1000. So he's essentially going to be riding a sort of dumbed-down version of the bike he rode last year. Now, Richard Cooper has already proven, Dre, that he can challenge for the title in Superstock 1000, and he'll surely be among the title favourites for next season. And it kind of... It asks an interesting question, which I think you can ask of a number of riders in the field. It's kind of, which would you rather be? Would you rather be a midfielder in a stronger field, or would you rather be winning? And I'm not sure whether Richard Cooper, obviously, yeah, I don't think he's made the decision himself. He's essentially been forced down this route because they've signed Stapleford. But I guess from Cooper's point of view, he's probably going to do an awful lot of winning next year.
Looks like it. I mean, Superstock 1000 isn't the most stacked of categories as it was a few years ago. And we've seen guys hop in and out of that category before, like Danny Buchan, who is a guy who has podium-level speed in him in the main series proper. So, yeah, I think it's a very interesting debate you make. Like, do you want to be the big fish? Or do you want to be fighting and scrapping in the midfield in British Superbikes? I mean, I'm not sure which is the best way to go about it. I mean, you've got to ask riders. I think you've got to ask them what their motivations are. Is it a financial thing? Is it a matter of being on TV? Is there no substitute for winning? You know, are you more strategic about how your career plays out? There's a lot of different factors at play here. I don't think there's any easy answer to that one. But Cooper, on a sheer perspective of when it comes the talent and what I think of him, I think he's more than good enough to dominate that class this year. He's a fantastic, talented rider. Another guy like Pedrosa, who I'm going to mention in a minute, who's quite small but fully utilises his size to ride very well indeed. We all know he's a BSB multiple race winner, so he knows what he's doing and he knows how to win races, especially in slippery conditions too. Bit of a wet weather guy as well. But yeah, I'm not sure Stapleford was a better play on this one. Don't get me wrong. I think that's the sort of talent that is worth getting excited about and you compromise on a little bit. But at the same time, Richard Cooper is a quality rider and is a guy who, at minimum, should probably be in a midfield team in BSB. And yeah, not sure how that's going to play out for Build Base on this one. I know they're kind of still a little bit salty about Gintoli not working out, but hey, Bradley Ray's breakout season kind of made up for it. But it's interesting. I'm not quite sure what the right move is on that one.
Yeah, I guess time will tell on that one. I mean, you make a good point on Stapleford in terms of he doesn't have the super bike experience that Cooper has. All of his experience as a motorcycle racer predominantly is on super sport bikes. So we don't yet know whether he can make that step up to more powerful machinery. He seems more at home on a super sport bike. So we shall see. We'll talk a lot more, of course, about British Superbikes as the year unfolds. Their season starts at Silverstone on the national circuit around Easter time. For this show, though, with no racing to speak of over the winter, we have to find other things to talk about to fill our monthly or fortnightly shows. So we decided for this this edition of Bike Live episode 91 to do something that we didn't really have time to do at the end of last season with so much going on and championships being decided left, right and centre. And that's to celebrate the career of Dani Pedrosa, which, of course, is now as an active rider in racing terms, has now come to an end as he becomes a tester for KTM. And we will do that right after this. Right, so you're back with us on Bike Live, episode 91. And let's talk about Dani Pedrosa, who called time on his MotoGP career at the end of last year. It's a Grand Prix career, if you go across all classes, that has spanned across 18 seasons from making his debut back in 2001. And the first thing that stands out to us, Dre, well, we'll kind of go all around the houses. We've got no real linear way of doing this, look back on Dani Pedrosa. We'll probably go off on a few tangents as we talk about his career. But there's one thing that immediately stands out, I think, when you look at Dani Pedrosa's career. You just look at the sheer table of his career. And there are very few riders that you could say, particularly over this sort of longevity of career, have done their entire career on one manufacturer of motorcycle. Mm. 18 years. He's almost like a biking Ryan Giggs, isn't he? The sort of one club man. Where it's a measure, really, of how good Dani Pedrosa has been, but also how highly regarded he is or has been within Honda, that he's stayed with that same manufacturer for 18 consecutive years.
That's unbelievable. I'm glad you made the football. Same point is that in football, for example, those sorts of one club men are very rare these days. It's seemingly that era, I think, of football, I think, has died. I think managerial wise and player wise, we just don't get that anymore, where guys are spending their entire careers at one club, or they're recognizable for most for one club. I think that era is sort of passing us by, and in bike racing, it's very, very rare now. I mean, it's a blessing in this in disguise, where there's now more than one competitive manufacturer in the top flight now. There's now arguably three or four, which is great for the health of the sport, because we've been dying to get this now for like a decade, where it was either you're in orange or you're in blue, and occasionally the guy in red might win too, but like anything else would be just considered freakish. Now it's like, and then the one guy that has stood the test of time, and we will always know him in either the movie star colors in the days, and he was still a teenager working his way up, but most probably the orange of Repsol Honda, that he spent his entire career there, an entire 18 years of Honda backed machinery, which is incredible. Like, that's in motorsport, that is so rare. In sport in general, that is so rare to have such, not just loyalty on Pedrosa's end to one manufacturer or one brand. And you know how we only ever really spoke about Pedrosa leaving Honda maybe this past year, about possibly going to the Petronas backed Yamaha team. And hey, they even came out earlier this week and said straight up that, hey, we very nearly got him, basically, but he chose to retire instead. But not, as you said, not only the fierce loyalty to, you know, to Honda, but also the belief that Honda's always had in him.
I was about to say, the loyalty that's been shown in both directions. Because when you look at Honda, if you're talking about the MotoGP portion of Pedrosa's career, we're talking about Repsol Honda, who as we're going to discuss, weren't always the championship favourites through this period, but they were always, you know, amongst the contenders. They were always front runners. They were, which the point I'm making is, Repsol Honda, basically, throughout that 12-13 year period that Danny Pedrosa wrote for them, they were in a position financially and in terms of their stature, they could have had the pick of any rider they wanted to ride for their bikes, which means that at any opportunity, they could have decided, we don't want Danny Pedrosa, we're going to go get X instead. Yet they, throughout that period, at no stage did Repsol Honda come close or even consider cutting Pedrosa.
Never. Not, I think, only the only even half rumbling of this was 2013. And that was when some talented fella called Mark came along, who we all know was a true transcendent talent, which, you know, was, even while though he was rough around the edges, was still a once in a generation sort of talent, and you couldn't pass that opportunity up. You could make the case that back in 2006, Pedrosa was that guy too. We forget that he had, you know, he had won 250 titles, and yeah, he was freakishly good from a young age, and made his MotoGP debut. I want to say at 21, I think he made his top flight debut. So, like, he was just under what became the age limit.
In fact, he'll have been 20. He wouldn't have turned 21 until September in 2006.
Yeah, so there you go. So he was 20 when he made his top flight debut, just like Marquez did in that sense. And again, he had the same, I'd argue, level of prestige and hype going into his top flight career that Marquez did back, you know, only just really 7 years or so apart. And you're absolutely right. Repsol Honda was still coming off the Valentino Rossi era, to a degree, where Rossi had brought them success in the early 2000s, and Nicky Hayden was a big flashy move because Hayden, you know, had come from America and he dominated out there, and you know he'd had the odd win here or there, but you're right, they could have had anyone they wanted in that top fight. They could have had maybe a Loris Caparossi, or if they wanted to gamble on Sete Gibernau, or maybe take a punt on Casey Stoner at that point before Ducati's factory team did in the end. And well, we all know how well that turned out for them. But they had a who's who. I mean, Honda was, you know, or still is to this day, you know, one of the most reputable teams out there. It's one of the most recognizable teams out there. They have a reputation where they can get whoever they want. It's a seat that is naturally appealing, and it has been for the best part of two decades now. And they gambled on a 20-year-old Pedrosa, and yeah, it worked out in the end. So you're absolutely right. Pedrosa was never going to be a sure thing, but when they actually gave him a chance, look how well it turned out.
Absolutely, it worked out very, very well for them, indeed. We'll touch briefly on his time in the lower classes, because, of course, he was the dominant lightweight rider through the early part of the 21st century. He was essentially the dominant lightweight rider in another sense, because he was lightweight himself. He was a tiny young man back at the times when the lightweight classes in Grand Prix racing were 125 and 250, rather than Moto 3 as it is now, which is a 250 class, and Moto 2, which for the last number of years has been a 600 class, and of course will be 675 with Triumph next year. Riders Danny Pedrosa's class were able to make a career of themselves in the lower classes, and he would win three consecutive world titles through 2003 to 2005. The first of those in 125, winning the championship several rounds early before getting injured shortly after winning the title in Malaysia. He would then miss the last two rounds due to injury and still win the championship by 57 points from Alex De Angelis, who was the runner-up that year. Pedrosa, of course, on the Honda, leading a triumph of Aprilias just behind him. And then his 2 years in 250s, back-to-back titles again. He won his first title comfortably ahead of Sebastian Porto before taking back-to-back titles in 2005. And when I tell you that the top five in that 2005 250cc title were, in this order, Danny Pedrosa, Casey Stoner, Andrea Dovizioso, Hiroshi Aoyama, and Jorge Lorenzo, it tells you the standard and the caliber of the rider in the class at that time, that Danny Pedrosa didn't just beat, but beat convincingly, winning some eight rounds on his way to winning the championship by 55 points from Stoner, who, as I mentioned, was the runner-up at that time. But really, Dre, it was sort of this time that the Pedrosa-Lorenzo rivalry kind of first came to light.
Mm. Yeah, that's where we first saw it happen. I mean, as you mentioned, what an incredible stack of talent that was in that 250 class that year in 2005. Four of the top five were world champions in some capacity, and even Hiroshi Oyama was a veteran in MotoGP for a long time as well, and was a championship runner up in his own right later on in his career. But it was that was the first shades of, like, I mentioned this before, but it was the beginning of the rise of Spain as a racing country again. I mean, like, for a while it had been dominated by Italy and the Americans, where the Americans had come over guys like Kenny Roberts Jr. and Nicky Hayden and had success.
And these were the two golden children, weren't they?
Yeah, they, like, this was the revolution that kickstarted Spanish Grand Prix motorcycle racing again. Like, Lorenzo and Pedrosa were both similar, and they're like, Lorenzo, if you've ever watched the docufilm Hitting the Apex, there's a great set of segments about this, especially on I thought Lorenzo's segment was fascinating, about how he was pretty much forced onto mini motos from the time he was, you know, 2 or 3 years old, and he was ridiculously disciplined. Like, this was the career path that Lorenzo was going to go down one way or another, and you had that incredibly workman's like Lorenzo come through at the same time as Pedrosa. I mean, Pedrosa jumped the queue by a couple of years by comparison. It wasn't for a couple of years afterwards, and Lorenzo, after Pedrosa's departure, Lorenzo stepped up, and then he won back-to-back titles himself in 06 and 07 before making his GP debut in 08. But by the time we got to 2010, those two were at war with each other. They hated each other, and they were literally fighting for the Spanish tabloid column inches. And, you know, King of Spain had to force them to shake hands in Catalonia. Like, it was toxic between those two, and it all started out here in 250s. But, if you want to pinpoint really the moment where Spain got back on the map from a biking standpoint, the mid-2000s that led to Lorenzo's resurgence, to coming up through the classes, and eventually guys like Marc Marquez being on the top of the pile. So you could pinpoint it right back here to the mid-2000s and the rise of Pedrosa, and basically, in a sense, inspiring a lot of Spanish riders to have another crack at it.
And Dani Pedrosa would move into MotoGP, as we mentioned, in 2006. Would win just his fourth Grand Prix in the MotoGP Premier class. And I think we have to put this into context, Ray, because people will say, well, Marc Marquez moved up and won his third attempt in the Circuit of the Americas back in 2013. But I think for Dani Pedrosa, who was, as I mentioned, a lightweight rider in every sense, he was tiny. And stepping onto, you know, the biggest, most powerful fire-breathing bikes in the world at a time when making the step up from the intermediate class to the premier class was probably the biggest and toughest it ever was and probably will ever be again. Moving from 250cc motorcycles to 990cc bikes in the premier class. And Dani Pedrosa not only stepped up, but won immediately.
It's crazy. You're right. I mean, again, let's not forget, we are still talking about a 5'2", 8-stone man riding a fire-breathing 250 horsepower, 990cc four-stroke. We forget just how difficult the four-stroke was to ride. Many people that are
he was second on his debut.
Yeah, it's bonkers. Like, the jump up in ferocity between 250s to MotoGP was bigger than it's ever been. Now the sport's kind of calibrated that way, and the Moto2 bikes now being 600s, they're a bit more relatable in that sense. But you look at that now, and look at that back then in 2006, where you're going from a 250 with maybe 80 horsepower to a 250 horsepower MotoGP bike with three times the power and four times the capacity of engine. And Pedrosa came in and was on podium on debut, and only took him four rounds to win a race. He was a freak. You know, he was a freak before they became fashionable. Yeah. In that sense. So, yeah, it's kind of crazy how quickly Pedrosa was able to adapt to the top flight. It is a testament to his level of ability. And again, as mentioned, he's a tiny man. He's giving up literally 2 to 3 stone to all his rival competitors out there. And when physicality is such an important part of riding these bikes, it's an incredible handicap. to have, and he was still so good right away.
He was, and he moved up to MotoGP at the same time in the same year as Casey Stoner, and scored near enough double the points of him. Now that has to be put into some context in that Pedrosa was with the Factory Upsil Honda team, Stoner was with the LCR satellite team, and Stoner was much more of a rough diamond at that time. He was a bit of a crasher at that point. He crashed out of six races that year, and missed another through injury from having crashed too. So Danny Pedrosa outscoring Stoner by that margin has a little to do with that, but Stoner was certainly not the finished article that Pedrosa was at the same age and the same stage in their careers. But as I mentioned, Danny Pedrosa would win just his fourth Premier Class race, which took place at Shanghai back at a time when bikes went there as well as cars, and would win there from pole position with the fastest lap, winning by a second and a half from his teammate, Nicky Hayden, who must have been wondering what on earth was going on in this team that had been his back in the mid-2000s, to see a young Spanish rookie come up, beat him on his first ride in Jerez in early 2006, where Pedrosa was second ahead of Hayden in third, and then win, leading home Hayden in just the fourth round of that season. Now, Nicky, of course, would have the last laugh, just about, in that season, but not before a monumental falling out at Estoril later that year. Now, it is one of the greatest motorcycle races ever seen. It's one of the most talked about MotoGP races of all time for two key reasons. The battle to the finish between Elias Roberts Jr., Rossi and Edwards that was decided by 2/1 of a second, and the championship implications that had, but also due to the one of the most talked about, one of the most shocking and stunning incidents ever seen in MotoGP, when Danny Pedrosa, as teammate to Nicky Hayden, knocked the championship leading Hayden off at Estoril early in that race when Hayden was leading the world championship. It could easily have cost Hayden his one and only shot, as it turned out, of realising his dream of being MotoGP world champion. And Danny Pedrosa, who we shouldn't forget, was actually a championship contender in his own right until midway through that season, when he, as it's going to become a bit of a theme, picked up injuries and had a few rounds where he wasn't quite on the pace and fell back. Only finished 37 points off the championship lead in the end himself that year. But in the end, had to play a supporting role to Hayden. And Dre, that incident at Estoril, It's still an incident that gets talked about now. It's still an incident that kind of beggars belief now that it happened back at Estoril in 2006. But the way Danny Pedrosa, helped by Hayden, it has to be said, handled that and bounced back from that was a testament to him for a rider who'd only just turned 21. That was a lot to take in.
Oh, God, yeah. Watch the Motorsport 101 YouTube channel. I made this a little while ago. But yeah, shameless plug aside, I mean, yes, this was one of the most iconic MotoGP races ever, in my opinion. It was a race that going into it, five men could have still won the championship. Pedrosa was the outsource on the outside looking in of those five. You know, Pedrosa still had an outside chance at the title at that point in time, and they were running, I think it was second and third at the time, and Hayden had literally just passed Pedrosa the lap before in quite an aggressive manner at that same corner. It was a very aggressive but fair move. Hayden had come through. I literally joke in said video that Pedrosa, you're probably best off not retaliating there, because that corner in Estoril famously has a bump on the apex. There's a bump on it, and if you ride over it in the wrong way, it's very, very easy to lose the front and tip it. And that's precisely what Pedrosa did a lap later. It was, a bit of a red mist moment with Pedrosa just like feeling like he had to retaliate straight away when he really didn't, especially when you look at how the race played out and how Estoril was very conducive towards, track racing and pack racing and it being close. We saw it, as we all know, it went down to literally a strip of paint on the finish line. Like, you've seen the emotion. Nicky Hayden loses his mind when he gets taken out in that moment in the gravel trap, because and you can't blame him, because you look at it and you go, well, he at the time we thought, well, that's it, title over.
And you've got to imagine that Danny Pedrosa must have thought that, because we always talk naturally and quite rightly about how that must have affected Hayden to lose his dream. But Danny Pedrosa didn't mean to knock him off. And you could just imagine the mental turmoil Danny must have been going through that day as a 21-year-old rookie, thinking, I've just cost the bloke his dream. I've just cost him the world title.
Yeah, you could tell. Like, and if there's one thing I always like about that, he's always been a classy, honest guy. What you see is what you get with Pedrosa. He never has spoken out of turn. I've always said this about Danny in that sense, where it's like, I've never heard a bad word said about him in the paddock. Ever. Not in the nearly 20 years he's been in it. He's just one of those genuinely good people. And you could see he was ravaged with guilt. So much so, he said for Valencia, I will get out of the way for Hayden to help him win the title. He felt like he owed Nicky and he owed Honda at least that, for it basically being accountable for what happened in Estoril. And we all know motorsport is packed full of team orders moments and teammates clashing with each other. Pedrosa handled that with an incredible sense of maturity and understanding for a kid who was only 21 at the time. It's a rare thing to see such decency and sportsmanship given out for who was a guy at the time was still a literal title rival. It was his teammate, sure, but they were both competing for the same title. They were both still eligible to win it when that crash happened. So for him to come out and do that afterwards was an incredibly noble gesture and a good reminder of just the maturity of Pedrosa to be able to handle what was one of the most famous MotoGP incidents of all time, a moment that went viral back for 06, and you know, a moment that will be talked about forever in MotoGP, that Repsol Honda clash at Estoril 06, and how it very nearly cost Hayden the title. Thanks, Tony. Checks in the mail still.
Yeah, as Joe mentioned, it didn't cost him the title in the end because of what happened, not just in the remainder of that race, but in the race that followed in Valencia. Valentino Rossi, of course, would crash out of the final round, having been overtaken by both Hondas and several others, it has to be said, early in that race. Rossi would fall off. Hayden and Pedrosa would finish third and fourth, respectively, and Hayden won the championship. And the rest is history, as they say, and one of the most heartwarming moments in motorsport and Grand Prix motorcycle racing history took place as Hayden realised his dream of winning the Motorcycle Racing World Championship. And really, from that point on, the balance of power shifted, didn't it, within that Repsol Honda team, and it became Pedrosa's team. Even as recently as the start of the next season, where Repsol Honda had a brand new bike, famously titled the Ghost Bike, that wasn't really on the pace initially. Hayden struggled by comparison to Pedrosa, who became, as a result, the lead rider within that team. And Pedrosa would go on to finish as the championship runner-up in 2007. Runner-up to a dominant Casey Stoner, who, as I mentioned, was rookie at the same time that Danny was. But he landed the switch to the factory Ducati team just as they became dominant with their new bike, their all-powerful bike that was just blowing riders away on the main straights in Qatar, and Bridgestone tyres, which would become a subject of controversy later on as Pedrosa, a couple of years later, would switch from Michelins to Bridgestones mid-season because he was unhappy with the Michelins and how they were performing. And Pedrosa would argue that he perhaps had a shot at the title as recently as the round that Stoner won it in Japan, but of course had a pretty painful crash through that weekend, and Stoner went on to win the title. But you kind of feel that Pedrosa, in some ways, although he's always been in one place, and that's Repsol Honda, you kind of have the feeling through his career that he was in the wrong place at the wrong time on the number of occasions. And Repsol Honda, who we know now as the dominant force in motorcycle racing, and through a lot of their existence have been the dominant team. It seems as though the years where Danny Pedrosa was not only the leader within that team, but also at his peak, were the years when Repsol Honda were going through something of a transition.
Yeah. Yeah, like the Hayden era had come and gone, and it probably had not worked out quite the way that it wanted to. I mean, Hayden won the world title, but it was clear as the years had gone on that he just wasn't the guy they wanted to build the team around. And you know, as this time had gone on, it had become clear that Pedrosa was the guy to lead that team going forward, and he was the staple Honda guy, while at the same time, just the sports around him was changing in that Casey Stone, obviously had the Exahead missile of a Ducati in 2007 that was literally
the first
6 miles
of the 800s, we should point out.
Yeah, the first year of the 800s, and Ducati were literally 6 miles an hour faster down Qatar than everybody else.
it was
a bit unfair, shall we say. And, you know, Pedrosa was leading that team going forward. And, yeah, as you say, as time was going on, we saw that Pedrosa step up to the team. Again, we saw Rossi come back to Yamaha again at another couple of titles. By that point, Lorenzo was really starting to find himself as a rider. 2010 comes around, and that was arguably the most consistent season in MotoGP history. We literally saw, you know, Lorenzo have a 383-point season where he finished, I think, every race in the top four that year, and it was virtually unstoppable with that level of form and consistency. Pedrosa, again, missed out due to Lorenzo's dominance. Stoner went to Honda in 11. Again, Stoner, we all know he's just an incredible talent, and he fit the Honda like a glove, and that was a three-bike team, so it was always going to be really hard for anyone to stand out, but Stoner won 11 times anyway. So it didn't matter in that sense. And yeah, by the time 2012 was really his best chance, when Stoner hurt himself in Indianapolis, but again, Lorenzo was too good. Just a little bit better than him, like 2 or 3% better, and that was enough. And by the time we got 2013, Marquez was there, and we all know the story with Marquez. So it was just, I don't want to say it wasn't like right place, right time, because he was never going to leave Honda. And if anything, Honda got a bit frustrated with him for not winning them a big one. But at the same time, he became the leader of that team, and until Stoner came along, and Stoner gave him the platform for a bit more temporary success.
And of course, we were talking about an era at that point where, as we touched on, Ducati were incredibly powerful in every respect. They had Casey Stoner as their lead rider, who they basically built the team around, even though Capirossi was still there for a couple of years. And of course, we shouldn't forget the all-conquering, all-powerful Rossi-Yamaha combination that was dominant at that time. Of course, 2006 and 2007 were barren years by their standards, although Rossi still nearly won the 2006 title. 2007, they didn't really come close, but back into 08 and 09, Rossi would win both of those titles at a canter, and of course Lorenzo would take over from him in 2010. So even though Pedrosa was Honda's lead rider through that period, they still weren't really a match for Yamaha and arguably Ducati when Stoner was healthy. So in many ways, that was the frustration for Pedrosa, that he couldn't quite overcome those two combinations in that time. But as I say, as his career went on, he would take on some of the best riders this sport has ever seen, Dre. Not just the likes of Rossi and Stoner that I mentioned on different motorcycles, but he would race against Dovizioso on Equal Machinery through 2009. And then 2011, when Dovizioso was in the factory Honda team. 2010, Dovizioso was still on the Honda, but in a different team. And Stoner would join Repsol Honda in 2011, before, of course, Marquez would take over upon Stoner's retirement. Now, Danny Pedrosa ultimately hasn't beaten any of those to a championship, but he has beaten them ample times each through his times with the team. And I've often drawn the comparison between Danny Pedrosa and Andy Murray. Across sports. Now, Andy Murray did ultimately win major titles. Danny Pedrosa didn't ultimately win a championship in MotoGP, but Danny Pedrosa, I think, is as good as the best riders of many, many eras. You can go back into the years of the 90s, the likes of Doohan and Cuvier, who rode for Repsol Honda. I think Danny Pedrosa could hold his own against either of those, and I think he could hold his own against the best riders of several eras. But unfortunately for him, and ultimately, this will always be held against Danny Pedrosa, he had to ride in the same era as Valentino Rossi, Jorge Lorenzo, and Casey Stoner, and Marc Marquez, four of the greatest riders in the history of our sport, who, with a bit of rough maths, they've won over 20 world championships between them.
Yeah. I mean, Marquez has 7, Rossi has 9, that's 16. Lorenzo has as 5. You know, that already is 21.
Yeah, Stone has a couple.
Stone has a couple as well. So yeah, you like Pedrosa is absolutely in that same discussion with all of those dudes, in my opinion. It's incredible. Like, that's one of the main reasons really he's been so unlucky and missed out, is that he's had to race in the greatest era for talent that this sport has ever seen. Like, we don't think we're ever going to get... This is like... We're in the middle, like... I'd say, actually, I'd argue we're kind of in the twilight of this era now, with Lorenzo being, you know, in his early 30s now. Dovi is in his early 30s. Pedrosa's obviously just retired. Rossi somehow is still going.
And he
turns 40 next year. And Pedrosa is absolutely in that conversation. He has beaten every great quality rider you can think of besides Marquez in the last decade and a half in some capacity. He's a truly exceptional rider, and he deserves to be mentioned in that pantheon of... Like I said, he's had to race against 4 of probably the top 12 riders who ever graced this sport. And he has been more than a match for all of them on several occasions. He is a truly brilliant bike rider. And, like, if you'd be doing him a disservice if you didn't mention him in the same conversation as all of those guys we've just mentioned, because Pedrosa had a key role to play in, not only, as I mentioned before, the Spanish Revolution in terms of biking talent, but also what's brought the sport into the modern era. Like, we've seen all of that. And Pedrosa's has been a key part of that for years and years and years. And he's been a staple, top flight, perennial contender for over a decade in the top flight. That's incredibly hard to do. This was really like the first year where the wheels have fallen off in that sense, in terms of Pedrosa's form and ability. But that's because he's been beaten up, and he's been through a long, long career. He's an exceptional talent, and to do this with that much talent around him is incredible. Deserves a lot of credit.
A MotoGP championship runner-up on 3 separate occasions, which again just tells you the depth of talent he was up against. 2007, he beat Rossi head-to-head that season, but lost to Stoner. 2010, he beat Rossi, he beat Stoner, but lost to Lorenzo. And likewise in 2012. I mean, some of the key moments through his career inevitably leads us to talk, Dre, about injuries. Because obviously every motorcycle rider gets injured through their career, but perhaps precious few have been injured as often and at the as sort of poor times as Danny Pedrosa. 2010 springs to mind, where of course he was very much a second favourite to Lorenzo by the time he travelled to Bateggi, but that terrible accident where his throttle stuck open and he crashed in practice and we wouldn't see him for the next 3 rounds cost him any chance of pushing Lorenzo close for that world championship. The very next season, 2011, the tangle with Simoncelli at Le Mans that saw him break his collarbone and miss the next 3 races was a real shame for him, that basically ruled him out of any hope of challenging Stoner for that year's championship. Because by the time Pedrosa returned to action at Mugello, he was out of contention, essentially, points-wise. But I think 2012, you mentioned it already, this wasn't a year where he missed a round through injury, but this was probably the round where, above any season, you kind of look at it and think, this could have been Danny's at the end of 2012. Right. He won 6 of the final 8 races that season. Probably the best run of form of Danny Pedrosa's career. But unfortunately, ultimately, it's the 2 that he didn't win that stick out. The crash in Australia 2 rounds from the finish ultimately cost him it, because that was the round that Lorenzo wrapped the title up, but he had to do the chasing. So you can kind of forgive him that one. But the round above any other, of all the races through Danny Pedrosa's career, all 295 of them, the one that I look back on with the most regret with is Misano 2012, where Danny Pedrosa's on pole position. His bike won't start on the grid before the main race, so he has to start from the back of the field. And then as he's coming through the field, he gets taken out in someone else's accident. That someone else being Hector Barbary, who has a crash and then just basically wipes Pedrosa out at the end of the back straight. Pedrosa would lose that championship ultimately by just 18 points. And with all due respect to Jorge Lorenzo, who was a brilliant champion that year, finished on 350 points and won the title. But Danny Pedrosa would finish that year on 332 points and wouldn't win the whole thing. And you kind of look back and feel that, I mean, when the guy finished, he finished every race, or every race he finished, should I say, he was in the top four. And every race he finished, bar one, was on the podium. That was a world champion caliber season, and ultimately, it kind of boiled down to that disastrous 5 minutes at Misano.
We forget that outside of Lorenzo's two DNFs that season, he finished every race. He finished that season first or second.
Yeah.
Again, it's the unfortunate...
And only won by 18 points.
Yeah, it's crazy. It is the most, like, ridiculous set of circumstances. Like, I don't think we'll ever see somebody win for school 332 points and not win the title. That's more than enough as a win in total in many an era and in many a season. That absolutely would have done it. And it's awful that Misano won. You got to look at it and you just got to go, well, damn. Because it was just so unlucky. The bike didn't start, and then when it did, he got collected. And that, not that we knew it at the time, was what ultimately did him in. If he recovers and, you know, gets into the top six, he still he might even win the title with that. I mean, Australia, again, those are the two races that stood out. He went on a tear at the end of the year. He got the better of Lorenzo in those head-to-heads all the way through the end of the season. And then it just wasn't enough. 332 points was not enough to win the title. I find that terrifying.
Yeah, in points-wise, it was his best ever season. And, I mean, 332... That would have won him the MotoGP World Championship in any of the last four seasons. It would have won him the championship in 2009 when Rossi won it. It would have won him the championship, of course, in 2006, where it was a relatively low number that Hayden won it with 252. But yeah, not only did he, as we've already discussed, come up against some of the greats of the sport, but dominant champions. We've already discussed how in previous shows and previous years how infrequent it really is in MotoGP that we have final round championship deciders, and that's because the champion invariably wins it comfortably. He often invariably dominates it and wins it by a mile, and it's often not been a rider within Pedrosa's team that's done it. Some of these great wins, I don't know if there's any wins that stand out to you, Dre, in Pedrosa's career, but one that stands out to me was later that season. I was kind of glad Pedrosa got it to round off that season, the final round in Valencia of 2012, where it was a bizarre start to the race, where half the field, because it was a flag-to-flag race, started from the pit lane because they decided at the end of the formation lap to change tyres from wets to slicks. Pedrosa was among them. Still to this day, with the exception of that bizarre race at the Saxon Ring where practically everyone started from the pit lane, to this day, the only MotoGP race that has been won via a pit lane start.
Yeah, and it's even crazier. So Katsunagasuka was second that day.
Yeah,
it was a fun day. It was a fun race. The only ever race won by a pit lane start, Pedrosa was rampant that day. Like he was ridiculous. That day in Valencia, so fast, just roared through the field in dramatic fashion, and was just so confident out there on what were still very, very slippery conditions.
Conditions that we thought early in Pedrosa's career that he couldn't ride it.
Yeah, we all thought, oh, he's not a whatever guy. He can't handle the bike in the... well, no. It turns out that he could. He was super fast at that point in time. Completely. He was so good. And that was probably the one, the Pedrosa race besides Estoril 06 that stands out to me the most. I also want to... mention Aragon in 2015 in the fight against Valentino Rossi, and a nice reminder of what Pedrosa was capable of. Because we weren't talking about Pedrosa in quite the same context as like a title threat and whatnot by 2015, but in a race where Lorenzo had obviously taken off and won, because we all know he loves it, Rossi and Pedrosa were in the fight for second that day, and they got into a dogfight. They got into a dogfight that day. It was a really, really great fight. And Pedrosa just about came out, which was actually a bit of a minor surprise, given that, you know, they were both fighting for the title. And yeah, like, Pedrosa was title spoiler. Well, before we knew the other major title spoiler of that season. But Pedrosa, you know, won a good clean fight that day with Valentina Rossi and Aragon, while I was already in the podium doing the shark fin celebration. It was a fun weekend.
Yeah, it was. And I mean, some of the other victories, I mean, later that season, you've already talked about the role of title spoiler that someone else played that season, Mark Marquez, and what happened in Sepang that year. It's still criminal that it gets forgotten how dominant Danny Pedrosa was that day in winning the race by a country mile whilst that madness was happening behind him, several seconds behind him, as it goes. Earlier that same season as well, 2015, we've already talked about how Danny Pedrosa, for a long time in his MotoGP career, was pathetic in the wet. But as recent as Motegi 2015, in pouring rain in those wet conditions where we were expecting it to be Rossi versus Lorenzo as they were chanting for the championship and they were together on the front row. And Danny Pedrosa came from nowhere to beat the pair of them by quite comfortably in the wet conditions, proving that he is a man for all days, all weathers, all conditions. And a terrific win there. It's a shame in many ways he didn't win a Grand Prix at all last season, because it would have completed a MotoGP career that would have seen him win in every championship season he competed in the Premier class. The only seasons, as I said at the start of the show, that he didn't win in through his entire Grand Prix career were his first and his last. And this season, 2018, was the only career in his entire Grand Prix career, the only season that he did not stand on the podium at all. He even did that in his rookie 125 season. And if I run you through his final championship positions, Dre, from 2001 to last year, 8th, 3rd, 1st, 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 5th, 2nd, 3rd, 3rd, 2nd, 4th, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 4th, 6th, 4th, and then 11th last year. No rider, not even Rossi, not even Lorenzo, perhaps Marquez, but hasn't done it over that length of time yet, can claim to have been that good for that long.
No. Like, Valentino might be the only guy that comes close, and even then he had a couple of rough patches with the Ducati era, and you know, when his return to Yamaha, we forget, didn't go very smoothly until a couple of years later, really. Pedrosa has been the consistently top tier rider of the last 20 years, which, to say a career has lasted 20 years in the world of bike racing is a rare spectacle in the modern era. Again, Valentino, the only really guy in there that comes close now, and we all know he's a freak in that context anyway. But to be able to be a Grand Prix race winner, I mean, look, you know how many brilliant riders have come through the sport and never even won one Grand Prix, and let alone a guy has done it for, you know, 16 consecutive seasons. Yeah. He was a Grand Prix race winner.
Pedrosa has 54 career wins across all classes.
I think that's about 7th on the all-time list, if I remember correctly. Isn't that
And 31 of those in the top class.
Yeah, 31 top flight wins. That's an incredible number. That holds up with the very best his sport's ever had. The way I see it, he's a Hall of Famer. He moonwalks into the Hall of Fame. He's the greatest rider to have never won a top flight title.
just to confirm you on the figures, he is equal 7th all time for most Grand Prix wins, level with Mick Doohan.
Yeah. Mick Doohan. He had quite the career in that sense.
The only riders ahead of him are Agostini, Rossi, Nieto, Hailwood, Marquez, Lorenzo, and of course he's level with Doohan.
True greats.
Yeah.
Like, you're talking about the greatest riders that have walked this earth are on that list in some capacity. And Pedrosa's in the conversation. And like you said, the testament to, like, when you put it all together, 54 career wins, 3 world titles, you know, a runner-up in the top flight on 3 occasions, a top 3 finisher on 7 occasions, a Grand Prix winner for 16 consecutive years, a guy that has overcome hellacious injury, and physical limitations given his size in a sport where it's such a massive factor. And the fact he's left with his reputation completely untarnished. He walks out, you know, as a real stand-up, honourable guy in this sport. I remember seeing like the great stories of people like Ben Spies coming out and talking about Pedrosa and saying that, you know, my first day in GP, Pedrosa sat down and he wanted to talk to me and he's been a lifelong friend ever since, basically. That's the sort of guy that Pedrosa is. He is an infectiously likeable, classy man who we can, like... It's like 2019 is going to be an incredible year for talent. We all know that, but it does feel like a hole is missing, knowing that Pedrosa is not there, which is crazy when you look at it. And you just go, wow! Like first time in over a decade that we're not going to see Pedrosa on the top flight. It's weird seeing that grid without him and seeing Lorenzo there. Instead, he's become such a staple of MotoGP, but he's a truly incredible rider, and his story and how he got to this point. And despite all the circumstances, it just shows you just how special a talent he is. There's only been one like Pedrosa like that, really. And yeah, he's pretty special.
He is pretty special. Beautifully summed up. And we thank Danny Pedrosa for the memories across his MotoGP career. As we've mentioned, it spanned 295 races across all classes. He won 54 of them. So just short of 1-in-6 ratio, 153 podiums, so more than a 1-in-2 ratio for getting on the podium, 49 pole positions, 64 fastest laps, over 4,000 points, and those three world titles, two of which were in 250cc in back-to-back years, and one in 125s. So those three titles coming in consecutive years, 2003, 2004, and 2005. This MotoGP season, as we mentioned, will go on without Danny Pedrosa in 2019. And before we go, let's look ahead to what is probably going to dominate our next show on Bike Live in a couple of weeks' time. And that is the Sepang MotoGP preseason test, which takes place very, very soon. What are we looking for in this one, Dre? I mean, it's going to be a test that takes place without Pedrosa. As we mentioned, he won't be on the KTM. It'll take place without Lorenzo, who won't be on the Honda. It's going to be probably a half-fit Marc Marquez. So there are many, many sort of riders and teams performances that we might have to take with a pinch of salt. Ducati won't run their new frame until the Qatar test. So I guess the team that we're looking at mostly, much like we did in Valencia, to see what they've done over the winter, are Yamaha.
Yeah, that's probably fair to say. We're going to find out what the bike looks like first. I'm sure that'll be interesting in its own right. I have a 2-1 bet with Ryan that the bike's going to be black. He thinks it's still going to be blue. More on that next episode. I suspect I'll be making good money on this for some time. But yeah, Yamaha is the big smoking gun. We all know Honda. Honda was very happy coming out of Valencia. Ducati seemingly was very happy coming out of Valencia. Yamaha was still, a lot of their struggles were brought up.
And again at Jerez, because they were fine. What was weird, because Yamaha ended up finishing the season very strongly. You know, won in Australia, probably would have won in Sepang had Rossi not fallen off, and then were on pole for Valencia before it rained on the Sunday. And, you know, Rossi was in the fight for that race as well, though, as I say, it wasn't the pouring rain. And then Vinales topped the test in Valencia, but... And we saw Morbidelli quick on the Yamaha as well. But then Jerez, by comparison, they weren't particularly strong. And they didn't still seem to be completely certain in their heads which direction they were going to go in for the 2019 bike. And given how late it now is, we're talking, you know, end of January here. If they get it wrong and they turn up for the test in Sepang and they've got it wrong, they're really against the clock to remedy those problems.
It's a problem. Remember, they've got to lock in their engine homologation. So, yeah, like this is going to be a problem. Like I mentioned, and David mentioned this in his pre-season preview as well for 2019, saying, well, it's becoming pretty evident that they're going to have to make their minds up soon. Who is going to be their rider? They're going to develop the bike around. They can't. It's clear that Maverick and Valentino want very different things out of what the Yamaha is producing right now. Vinales has been openly frustrated about how Ramon Forcada wouldn't let him be a bit more radical when it came to development changes and obviously setup changes for the bike. And, well, last season didn't really help because, well, Valentino won and got the plaudits for dragging that bike into play on numerous occasions. He only was better than Maverick by 5 points in the end. So it was kind of inconclusive on that one, if you're looking at it from a purely impartial standpoint. Yamaha's going to have to make a call on this pretty soon. Like, are you going to ride Valentino Rossi until he can go no longer? Or are you making this the Maverick Vinales team now and you're going to let Rossi sail into the sunset? Like, they've got to make a decision on this now, because if they keep being indecisive, Maverick is going to win another title. And if Yamaha goes another year without a major title and they only have maybe one win for the season like they did this past season, Jarvis could be out of that team. Like, we've already had like crew chiefs and other guys apologize for the team. We've seen guys move on from Yamaha as a result of this already. They're under a lot of pressure for this one to be successful. I don't think Yamaha's big ups are going to tolerate another year of incompetence. So this is a massive test for Yamaha and where they're at compared to everybody else in the field.
Yes, we will discuss that on our next Bike Live episode 92, which will, in all probability, be 2 weeks' time. It will be the other side of the Sepang test, basically. So keep an eye out for that. We'll announce the details on social media and indeed on the Discord server, which if you would like to be a part of for this off-season, just shoot either of us or any of the Monospot 101 regulars that you listen to on either our podcasts a message, however you can get in touch with us, be it Twitter, Facebook, or any other way, and we'll sort you out with an invite into our Discord server for this winter break. If you want to be part of it regularly, back us on Patreon, patreon.com/Motorsport101. If you back us at the $5 level, you get the podcast earlier than everyone else. If you back us at the $10 level, you do get access to our Discord server permanently, and you can listen to these podcasts live as they happen. Other places you can find us: facebook.com/motorsport101, on Twitter we are @motorsport_101. Our YouTube channel is youtube.com/motorsport101, and our website is motorsport101.com. Don't forget, of course, you can find our podcast everywhere where all good podcasts are released, and that now does include Spotify. So all the details, as I mentioned, motorsport101.com. The Motorsport 101 podcast itself returns next week, I believe, Dre. I think it's episode 177 are we up to now? It's that we're getting into such high numbers now that it is difficult to keep track. But actually, quite even though it is still January, it's gonna be quite a lot to talk about next week, because we had the Santiago Ypres and a race that one of our Patreon backers, Cam, is particularly looking forward to, the Rolex 24.
He's not mentioned it at all, honestly.
No.
Christopher Dehaene is going to be actually live there at Daytona. Well, friend of the show, Lizzie Worth, is down there as well. She's been a guest for us on multiple occasions. She's down there as well. But yeah, it is a massive weekend. Again, as mentioned, Santiago Ypres in Chile this weekend. A big one there. Well, I wonder, is BMW still going to be on top? Is the going to come into play again? And will the BMWs not try and take each other out this week? That would probably be preferable. So yeah, the Santiago Ypres this weekend and the big one, the IMSA Rolex 24 Hours of Daytona, one of our favorite races of the year, the landmark event on the IMSA calendar. And basically, as I like to say, the all-star game of motorsport. Stuff your race of champions and nonsense. Before we get another 50 think pieces about how an esports guy beat Lucas Degrassi. As hilarious as that is.
Yeah, it is.
So all of that, the Rolex 24, the race of champions, and the Santiago Ypres as well, all in episode 177 of Motorsport 101, and that'll be a lot around about this time next weekend.
Yeah, so do keep your eyes out for that. As I mentioned, we'll be back for episode 92 in a couple of weeks' time to talk all about the Sepang test. And then we will be very quickly into motorbike racing season once again. Episode 93, in all probability, despite the obvious opportunity to build it around Marc Marquez, episode 93 will almost certainly be our World Superbike and Supersport season preview. So keep an eye out for that into February. But that's all for now from Andre Harrison and myself. We thank you for listening, and we thank Danny Pedrosa for 18 wonderful years in Grand Prix motorcycle racing. From the two of us, we will see you in a fortnight.